This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. Pathologies of the blood vessels of the retina are among the major causes of blindness worldwide. Any abnormality affecting the retinal blood vessels during their development, or even at later stages of life, will lead to these severe pathologies. And research has recently shed light on the mechanisms that regulate retinal vascular development, and they offer hope to reaching the goal of preventing and treating blindness caused by these pathologies. Here with more on this is Dr. William Brunken. He's professor of ophthalmology and of neuroscience and physiology at Upstate Medical University. Dr. Brunken is also the new vice chair for research for ophthalmology at Upstate as well. Welcome, Dr. Brunken. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, thanks very much, Linda.
So you've been engaged in research into retinal pathologies responsible for blindness for quite some time. Give us a little bit of an overview of your work.
Yeah, sure. I started my graduate work actually in New York State, actually at SUNY Stony Brook. And we moved from there in what seems an embarrassingly long time ago, in 1980, to New York City, where I finished my work at NYU. And then I moved from there on to a postdoctoral fellowship at Washington University, and then the faculty at WashU. My early work was really focused on how the neurons of the retina talk to each other. And what I was really interested in is how neural networks form connections between each other, and in fact, how they talk to each other. And the idea was that we could identify then specific circuits that use different chemicals to talk to each other, and that would underline disease. And in fact, when I moved my laboratory from St. Louis to Boston, what we did is we identified a mechanism, a transmitter mechanism, a neurochemical mechanism in the retina that uses the neurotransmitter serotonin. Serotonin has now become quite famous because it's at the heart of many depressions. Our lab was the first lab to show that you could actually separate serotonin uptake into different neurons. So this led to a very fruitful area. But from there, I got interested in what are what we call in the field epigenetic mechanisms, that is, things that lie outside the genome. The human genome is about 20,000 genes, and our genome is 99.9% like a chimpanzee's and about 99% like your average dog. Mm. We're clearly not a chimpanzee nor a dog, and so the mechanisms that direct who we are and who we are as a species, as well as who we are as people, clearly are not just in the genome. And the
in fact, it's the epigenetics, it's the things outside. It's almost like the environment that the genes find themselves in.
Exactly. So this is very much like the sort of debate in nature versus nurture for children. When you have, do children adopt bad behaviors because they have bad genes, or are they in a bad environment?
Right.
And in fact, it's both of those
things.
It's a combination of those things. And so what we launched on then was taking our knowledge of basic circuits in the retina, what are the epigenetic mechanisms? And I focused in on a group of molecules that are called laminins. These are molecules of the extracellular matrix. The extracellular matrix are the proteins that surround all cells. They provide the substrate that cells live in and on.
They're homes.
Couches for being couch potatoes, the highways that they migrate on when they need to move from one place to another, and actually also the signposts that give them direction, telling them which is up, which is down, which is left, which is right. And these molecules are absolutely critical for embryonic development. In fact, they're the earliest ones, some of the earliest ones that turn on, and they're expressed early in human development, as well as mammalian development, but also in the animal radiation, that is, in animal evolution. These molecules appear just when metazoans appear. And a metazoan is an animal that has different kinds of tissues. So when we were all single-cell things, you didn't need these molecules because every cell was identical. Once cells came together to make an organism that had to have a mouth and a gut and an eye of some sort, you needed these molecules in part to help differentiate what
those cells... To tell the cells what to be, who to be, how to grow, how to develop, and what type of cell to become.
Absolutely.
How to mature.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we've been working on. And what we know that these molecules, by using genetic mechanisms, we can manipulate these genes in a mouse. We've taken out things that are called laminin beta 2, gamma 3. Their names are not really important to your audience. What's important is the concepts. We can take the genes out, and we perturb development in what becomes an observable way. So we can go back and ask, how are these related to human disease? What we've uncovered is that one of the genes we study is related to a very obscure disease called Poisson's syndrome. It was a French doctor who identified it, and it's a blinding disorder that also has kidney problems. Another one of our genes, in collaboration with a group at Yale, we've identified is associated with autism.
Really?
The autism is a result of the defects that we've now published in brain development. And so these things are guiding how cells take on their fate, their names, whether they become X cell or Y cell or Z cell, and in what order.
So these are the signaling mechanisms, as you said, and the directives that these cells abide by. So what is the direct clinical significance of that, those types of findings?
So one clinical finding is, of course, the relationship to human congenital disease. But that, on some level, is the most trivial of the things. It tells us what the cause of the disease is. In large part, these molecules can't easily be fixed by...
Can or cannot?
Cannot easily be fixed by gene transfer. They're complicated genes, and there's a whole host of reasons why they're not. What's more probably important is their role in ongoing processes in the adult, and that's where the retinal vasculature comes in that you mentioned. So retinal vasculature in a human or a mouse is the responsibility of a set of cells growing over the surface of the retina that essentially call the blood vessels into the retina. They're not resident. And it's the complex interplay between the retinal neurons and those cells that cause the blood vessels to develop. Our molecules, laminins, are key interlopers, as you will, signaling elements between the neurons and these other cells called astrocytes in that process.
So, well, first of all, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with eye researcher Dr. William Brunken, and we're talking about his research into the causes of retinal blindness and the possible prevention. I guess I don't want to run out of time here. I just want to get to kind of a key point here. In all of these mechanisms that you found, are you saying that that these findings will translate somehow into either prevention in terms of atypical development, in other words, in the developing mm-hmm. child, or also in perhaps the aging population where we're losing retinal capability?
So there are a couple of possibilities for serious development. The mechanisms for blood vessel development, unlike bone development or brain development per se, actually stay active. That's the reason why what we call neovascularization, new blood vessels, cause disease. We've got a good handle on the control of these new blood vessels with anti-VEGF. You've probably heard about, your audience has probably heard about this treatment. It's used all the time now.
For macular degeneration.
For macular degeneration, for wet AMD.
Right.
These are injections into the eye.
And it stops the...
It stops the blood vessels, but it doesn't work for everyone. And so we can develop some of the laminin molecules into a new form of longer-term therapy. But the other thing we can use the laminins for, and this has actually been accomplished in a first run in Japan, is to actually use the laminins and other components of the extracellular matrix to build new ocular tissues.
Wow.
So a group in Japan took extracellular matrix components, stem cells that you've heard about, and actually grew an eye in a dish.
Wow.
And we're doing at Upstate some of those kinds of experiments where we've partnered with people in the College of Nanoscale Science and Engineering in Albany. And we're developing what we're calling biomimetic scaffolds. That is, these are substrates just like nets that we build.
Like almost a structure upon which you can put cells.
That's exactly right. And this is a structure that can a surgeon could then put, implant into the eye, and replace diseased tissue. This is a long way from being, you know, in at the clinic, but it's a developmental plan which I think is well underhand now.
Well, that segues me quickly into your other hat, which is as the vice chair for research. Tell me a little bit more about what the department is doing. I don't want to run out of time. We have about 3 minutes left. Tell me more about what's going on in the department.
So what I got attracted up here from my native New York City to come and lead what is a world-class group of vision researchers. Longstanding director, Dr. Robert Barlow, died quite suddenly back in 2009, and the group needed a new leader, and they reached out to me there, and we've got a group of essentially 8 vision researchers, mostly in the Department of Ophthalmology, but also in neuroscience and in neurosurgery, doing absolutely world-class research. The key now is to get that group and the group of very able clinicians, both here at Upstate and also throughout the SUNY system, interacting together. We've created this thing called the SUNY Eye Institute, which is a collection of researchers all across the state. That group of vision healthcare providers see 300,000 patients a year. That provides us an enormous access to translational research.
Translational, I'll just interrupt you a second. Translational being from basically bench to bedside.
From bench to bayside.
Yeah.
Bedside, yeah. And so this gives us a tremendous power, both in taking our basic research and making it clinically relevant, but also provides an incredible opportunity to develop an economy in the central New York area, which is actually based on high-tech biotechnology, something that with a combination of SUNY Buffalo, SUNY Albany, Syracuse, ESF, and in fact, the University of Rochester, central and western New York is blessed with some real powerhouse educational institutions.
And again, do you feel that the government sequester and other issues that have kind of impacted or have potentially had a chilling effect on basic science research, how have those affected your work?
So I have to divulge, I've been at this now for 30 years, and this is the worst period of time in my 30-year career. We are seeing funding levels that are just the worst ever. As a percent of GDP, the funding for scientific research by the federal government is the lowest it's been since the NIH was formed. NPR aired these shows, did a very good series of stories about how bad the funding level is. And it is, in fact, really killing the industry. And what it's doing is not only hobbling people like me who are in the middle of my career, or I'm actually getting to the last third of it, it's really taking away from the youth, the next generation, because they see how hard their mentors are struggling and they just don't want this lifestyle.
Sure.
And so we're going to cede to Europe and Japan and to China the leadership
on the cutting edge research.
On the cutting edge research, and we're going to lose it. And we've had it for 40 to 50 years, but we're in danger of losing that.
Yeah. Is there any opportunity just to partner with private industry as a way of providing a bit more of a
There is, and pharma, big pharma and little pharma are in a desperate state as well. Their pipeline for drugs is really low, so they're desperate for new ideas. The problem, however, is that pharma needs a short payout. They don't have a long-term plan. The government has always provided a long-term plan.
And all of this research takes
a
long view.
It takes decades. And so what has to happen is pharma can step in for the last development phase, but they can't do the basic research to get it to essentially clinical testing.
Well, all I can say is we hope that somehow this will turn around as the economy starts to rebound somewhat. I want to thank you so much. My guest has been Dr. William Brunken. He's professor of ophthalmology and of neuroscience and physiology at Upstate Medical University. Once again, thanks for joining us. I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.